It's Tuesday, May 17th, 2016, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Coming up, the Syrian support group meets to consider issues facing the war-torn nation. Iraq launches a Western operation against ISIS. A U.S. markswoman aims for Olympic gold. And a look at the Little Red Book, 50 years after China began its cultural revolution.
The thing you don't really want to look at, but you can't quite throw away.
It's all on today's International Edition. The five-year-old war in Syria was the focus for diplomats today in Vienna. The 17-nation International Syria Support Group met to discuss stalled political talks, difficulties in maintaining a ceasefire deal, and uneven UN results in delivering humanitarian aid. Afterward, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met with the news media.
No one can be remotely satisfied with the situation in Syria. It's deeply disturbing. And we are all concerned about the levels of violence that broke out in recent days, challenging the cessation. Russia has worked closely with the United States to upgrade our ability, which now has a 24-hour basis in Geneva with high-level people working consistently. But even then, it's difficult. And in the end, in order to make all of this more than words on a page, some very clear and determined actions are going to be needed in order to implement the steps that we just set out today. And we talked considerably about how that can happen and perhaps even what kind of enforcement mechanisms could be developed in order to achieve this full ceasefire that we are seeking.
VOA correspondent Pamela Dawkins was there, and she joins us now on the line from Vienna. Hi, Pam.
Hi, Susan.
Say, what did Mr. Kerry have to say about what was accomplished today?
Well, Susan, in a joint news conference with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and UN Special Envoy Stepan de Mistura, Kerry spelled out the measures the ISSG had agreed on to help reduce violence and spur the delivery of humanitarian aid in Syria. He said the group agreed that if a party to the ceasefire persistently violated the truce, then that party could be excluded from the agreement. He also said that as of June 1st, the World Food Program would make arrangements to accelerate airdrops and regular air flights into designated besieged areas if relief workers were denied humanitarian access. Also, the group urged rebels to disassociate themselves from Islamic State and al-Nusra Front terrorists. Lavrov said there had been a number of cases in which terrorist groups had made alliances with these groups that were part of the ceasefire. Now, Kerry appeared slightly irritated by a question on whether the U.S. was losing the ability to exert pressure on President Bashar al-Assad's regime to fully comply with agreements such as the adherence to the ceasefire, supporting talks on a political transition, and allowing unrestricted access to besieged areas for humanitarian aid. His response was, the United States of America always has leverage.
Was there optimism about Syria's future?
Well, the best way that I would describe it is that the process was mixed. Kerry Lavrov and de Mistura noted the ceasefire violations, the problems with getting in humanitarian access in some areas, and also the challenges with the political talks. But they all seemed resigned to forge ahead to try to implement the agreements that have been put in place.
So what is next on the support group's agenda?
It's unclear at this point when the group will meet again. More than likely, the next meeting will be in Geneva, and that would involve the UN-facilitated proximity talks between the Syrian regime and the opposition. UN envoy de Mistura declined to set a date. He said there were several factors, such as the upcoming Ramadan holiday. He also said he wanted to see if the cessation of hostilities improved, as well as the efforts to get humanitarian aid delivered.
Well, thank you very much, Pam, for speaking with us today from Vienna.
You're welcome.
Joining us here in the studio with more on this story is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you for having me.
So I hear this is kind of a hot topic today.
It is. We're seeing a lot of different hashtags, hashtag Syria Talks, hashtag ISSG, which stands for, of course, the International Syria Support Group. And we're seeing a lot of the key players tweeting out as well, including John Kerry. Secretary of State here in the U.S. tweeting out, the Department of State tweeting as well. We're seeing a lot of those leaders tweeting, but we're also seeing people saying, oh, it's just for show. It's just an opportunity for these people to get into a room and kind of say, oh, we're doing such a great job, but are they really doing anything? So people holding their feet to the fire, so to speak, on social media. We're even getting a glimpse at some of the protests. There are protesters outside of the meeting upset with the fact that Iran is involved in the meeting. And so we're seeing those protests on social media and their signs on social media, which really speaks to things like Twitter and Facebook being an amplifier for those voices. But lots of different coverage for this. We're seeing even bits and pieces of the resolutions they're agreeing to leaking out of the meeting and being tweeted out and spreading all over the world.
What else is trending today?
Well, we also have hashtag WD2016. Now, this is another meeting not too far from Vienna. It's in Copenhagen. It's the fourth Women Deliver conference, and what this is a conference to get women together and advocates for women to talk about things like maternal death rates, education, equal education around the world, really all of those different kind of women issues that the UN is looking to highlight. And so we're seeing different ways that social media is being used. The UN Women Twitter account, actually, they have a photo booth there in Copenhagen. People are going by and taking pictures, and they're tweeting out some of those pictures. So they're combining people in Denmark for that conference and putting them into social media. We're also seeing some of the big notable names. Melinda Gates is there, actress and activist Jessica Biel, and singer and activist Annie Lennox. So we're seeing a lot of their speeches, little bits and pieces from their remarks, and we're seeing them tweeting out as well.
Interesting. And anything else going on?
Well, those are the two big meetings for today, but we'll see what the day brings. The nice thing about social media is that if anything does develop, we'll see it there first.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
We invite our audience to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. In the top of the news, the five-year-old war in Syria was the focus of diplomats today in Vienna, where the 17-nation International Syria Support Group met. A wave of bombing struck markets across the Iraqi capital today, killing at least 68 people and injuring more than 100. Former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders face off in Democratic presidential nominating contests today in Kentucky and Oregon. The Cuban Foreign Ministry's head of U.S. affairs says the two countries have a very ambitious agenda for progressing their relations. And the IOC says 31 athletes from 2008 Olympics test positive for doping. News, feature reports, and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A group of astronomers say they have found a tiny, distant galaxy that has the lowest level of metals that has ever been detected. They added that their finding could provide new insight into the Big Bang, the explosive creation of the universe nearly 14 billion years ago. Astronomer and professor John Souser, co-author of a study outlining the discovery, says that low-metal galaxies are among the very few most promising ways to learn more about the conditions of the universe at its birth. Nicknamed Leoncino, or Little Lion, the faint blue galaxy is located in the Leo Minor constellation, some 30 million light years from Earth. It's thought that stars formed 100 to 200 million years after the Big Bang were mostly made of hydrogen and helium. Heavier elements were produced later by the stars themselves in a nuclear fusion process called stellar nucleosynthesis. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Security forces have announced the start of an operation to retake control of Arut Ba, a town in western Anbar province that links Islamic State-controlled areas with the Jordanian and Syrian borders. Reporter Chris Hannis has been following the story and joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Chris.
Hi.
Hey. Please tell us about the strategic importance of this region.
Sure. Well, there's a couple of key areas now remaining where Islamic State controls territory on both the Iraqi and Syrian sides of the border. This is one of them. It's in the western part of Iraq, the way western part of Iraq, near the corner where it borders both Jordan and Syria.
And I understand U.S. Defense Department spokesman Peter Cook had some comments about this.
Yeah, he came out yesterday and said, you know, basically, if you look at a map, you can see why this is an important area. because it basically connects in a straight line between Jordan through Rupa, all the way, if you keep following east, to Baghdad. And that's, you know, that's the area where Islamic State has not been able to actually get to Baghdad yet. And that's actually being kind of pushed back from areas there.
So they're hoping that if they get in there and they win, they can control that pattern of traffic.
Exactly. And keep, and especially in Anbar, is a big western province in Iraq, big kind of desert area. And if they can get this last remaining area and push further towards the Syrian border, that will really cut off a huge swath from the militants.
Back in 2014, Islamic State swept through what seemed like large areas of northern and western Iraq and part of eastern Syria. Tell us about that.
Exactly. That's when we really saw the group emerge, take what used to be sort of called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That was, you know, such a problem for U.S. forces there during the war. And really, it was really in a matter of about a month that you just saw them. All of a sudden, they were there. A big problem there was a lot of infighting among Iraqis, and the security forces there just were not ready for that kind of operation and were really kind of taken by surprise.
Well, what has happened since then?
Well, since then, we've seen a huge international effort over the past 2 years, really since about August of 2014, when the United States launched its coalition airstrikes, and you started to see Iraq really making a push to support the security force and get international support to bring in militias. And they have been able to push back. Cook yesterday said that they've been able to take back about 45% of the territory that Islamic State once controlled in Iraq, and as much as about 20% in Syria.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Chris.
Sure.
As we reported Monday, a multilateral group of 20 countries and 4 international organizations considered demands from Libya's new unity government for exemptions from a UN arms embargo. This would allow it to take steps to end the country's 5-year-old period of chaos, including the growing threat posed by the Islamic State. The talks included the Government of National Accords, the GNA, which only arrived in the country March 30th. It has the backing of Libya's Western administration, but not yet that of the internationally recognized Eastern government. Regional analyst Amin Saikal tells VOA's Victor Beatty, the officials wouldn't make such a commitment on the embargo exemption if they were not confident it would pass the Security Council.
I'm not really sure how the Russians and the Chinese will react, but obviously they may have already really canvassed some views from them, and they are confident that they are not going to create any obstacles.
This Government of National Accord has only been in the country for a matter of weeks. How confident are they that it can actually take care that these weapons don't fall into the wrong hands?
I don't think there is any guarantee on that front, and obviously Europeans and the American administrations are quite really probably concerned about that. But at the same time, they have decided that probably the National Unity Government is the only force which they could legitimately support in Libya and empower this government to be able to stand up to the Islamic State. But whether that's really going to happen, that remains to be seen, because the National Unity Government is very young and very fragile. It is not as coherent and as effective as one would have wished it to be. But the United States and its allies have decided to provide all economic and political and military assistance they can muster to this government.
Coming up on International Edition, shooting for Olympic gold. And who really did author The Little Red Book? Olympic athletes are training hard for the Summer Games in Rio de Janeiro, which start August 5th. A top American markswoman, 5-time Olympic medalist Kim Rhode, is aiming to win a 6th medal. Mike O'Sullivan caught up with her during practice at a shooting range in California and filed this report for VOA Television.
Kim Rhode shoots skeet and trap, aiming at 1 or 2 clay targets launched with different trajectories through the air. The sport requires fast reactions and a keen eye. She first competed in the Olympics 20 years ago in Atlanta and has brought home Olympic medals from every Games since then, including three golds. She loves being one of the world's top competitors.
And no matter what the event, we all kind of have that common thread or that common story of overcoming or never giving up that really, I think, speaks to the, you know, creed of the Olympics.
Sharpshooter Annie Oakley is one of her inspirations.
I mean, shooting was something that was kind of like the Wild Wild West. It was something that kind of is in the fiber of our country. And so, yeah, there's quite a few. Annie Oakley is definitely one. I definitely love the fact that she went out there and gave the boys a run for their money.
Rhodey gained national prominence at her first Olympic competition at age 16. Shooting has been a family activity, and Rhodey practices with her father, Richard.
My grandfather was a houndsman and grew up in Montana, and he basically brought all those hunting and tradition and outdoor heritages with him, and which time he taught my dad, and my mom and dad taught me.
And she has her eye on the target as she readies for the Rio Games.
It's really been an incredible journey, one that I feel very blessed and honored to have had.
Like other athletes from around the world, she hopes to bring home more Olympic gold from Rio. Her qualifying rounds for the Games wrap up this week. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
This is VOA.
Green Beat, for a healthier planet.
Few things are as important to our health as the air we breathe. So the United States Space Agency, NASA, with the help from South Korean scientists, are looking at ways to improve it. Smoke and industrial emissions cross into South Korea from the West, affecting its air quality. NASA's lead scientist in the study, James Crawford, says that makes South Korea a great place for the research.
A molecule in the atmosphere does not tell you where it came from. We have to learn how to model things better.
Two NASA aircrafts and a South Korean plane will collect ozone and particle measurements over South Korea's diverse topography.
For the last 5 years, our air quality work has been in the United States. Many of the things that we're studying here are similar in nature.
The study will also help NASA develop a space-borne science lab, expected to launch in the next 6 years, which will take air quality measurements across four continents. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
Years ago, the Chinese Communist Party started the country down a path to the Cultural Revolution, which it said would bring about a more just society, but in practice led to complete social and economic disaster. The seemingly momentous anniversary this year was all but ignored and met with virtual silence from China's state-run media. On May 16, 1966, Chinese Communist Party Chairman Mao Zedong began the campaign by purging several top party officials and announcing his agenda that ostensibly sought to return power to the working class that had been usurped by the bourgeois. One of the most powerful symbols used to promote Mao's grip on the nation was the Little Red Book. Alexander Cook, assistant professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley, author and editor of the book Mao's Little Red Book, A Global History, describes the big impact of the small text to VOA's Jim Stevenson.
The book is 50 years old. It definitely belongs to a bygone era, but it still has a little bit of residual power to it. It's a lightning rod for opinions. This is a book that gets translated into about 36 languages officially, unofficially, more like 50 languages. It's a book that takes on a life of its own and the history of all of these different nations around the world, and it's used in different ways.
Presumably, at the time, Mao was a little bit busy. He comes out with this book. How did he accomplish that?
Mao himself had very little to do with the actual creation of the book. It emerges in the early 1960s in China. It emerges from the military. The idea from it came from journalists inside the army. The editors and publishers of military newspapers kind of got into the habit of printing Mao quotations in the masthead of their newspapers. Then they started thinking, well, the quotation should fit whatever the lead news story is. So they needed kind of a topical index of quotations relating to all different kinds of situations and stories that might appear in the paper. And then from there, they created this kind of card catalog, and they got the idea to compile it together into a kind of a field manual for the soldiers. It's the field manual origins of the book that actually explain its peculiar little size. It has to fit into the breast pocket of an army uniform. and the famous red vinyl cover, which makes it waterproof. So it's really just designed to be convenient for a soldier to carry around, a little quick reference guide if you want to find an inspirational quotation on a particular topic. You pull it out of your pocket, open it up to the appropriate chapter, and 10 seconds later, you've got a Mao quote.
It is the internet or the text message of the day.
It really is. One of our contributors, Andrew Jones, who's also a professor at UC Berkeley, has a really interesting chapter on comparing the quotation to the sort of 60s phenomenon, pop song, musical hook. The book is portable, but the quotations, in a way, are kind of portable. They're kind of memorable. A lot of them would fit into a Twitter. They're just like little snippets that are easily movable and easily transmittable about. In Marxism, there's a longstanding criticism of capitalism and of commodity culture. This is kind of an instance where a really radical form of Marxism intersects with commodity culture.
And very iconic even to this day, as tourists can go around Beijing and other areas and see the little red book being sold in stalls.
Oh, very much so. I mean, you can buy the little red book today in China. It's a very popular tourist item. I think Chinese people feel a little bit more conflicted about it in a way. It's ubiquitous, but it's the kind of thing people keep in the bottom of a drawer, you know, maybe tied up with a lot of ambivalent kind of memories and nostalgia. The thing you don't really want to look at, but you can't quite throw away, it still has that kind of a power in China today. But the meaning of the book is really, I think, has changed over time. There's always kind of been this tension between the Little Red Book as something dangerous, subversive, but also kind of a comical pop culture light feeling about it.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner and scroll on down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The people of South Sudan are in trouble. More than two decades of North-South conflict, followed by over 2 years of factional fighting, have further weakened an already fragile nation. The insecurity has limited farmers' access to plant their fields and devastated livestock, resulting in inadequate food production. Today, South Sudan has the world's highest inflation rates. South Sudan's economy is collapsing, its people struggle to find enough to eat, and human rights violations and abuses continue with impunity, said Bob Levitt, USAID Deputy Assistant Administrator for Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Assistance. To date, some 2.5 million South Sudanese have fled their homes in search of food and safe haven from violence. This year, half the country's population, over 6 million people, need humanitarian assistance. The United States is South Sudan's largest donor. Working through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and in collaboration with various partners, the U.S. government has so far provided nearly $1.6 billion in humanitarian assistance for conflict-affected people in South Sudan and South Sudanese refugees. But the going has been tough, partly because it is so difficult to reach many of the communities most in need of aid. One of the reasons is because although the parties to the conflict are obligated under the peace agreement to allow humanitarian aid to flow without interference, aid workers continue to deal with lengthy negotiations, numerous checkpoints along major supply routes, and other obstacles, such as informal taxation and harassment, said Deputy Assistant Administrator Levitt. While we have been able to reach communities trapped in the crossfire through ad hoc negotiations, parties to the conflict have not yet demonstrated the political will to grant full and unfettered access nationwide. The United States is committed to helping the people of South Sudan get through this crisis and get back on their feet. We urge the government to prioritize humanitarian access so that we can reach those who most need our help, said Deputy Assistant Administrator Levitt. Our assistance to people in desperate need in South Sudan is saving lives. We will continue to invest in the people of South Sudan and their efforts to build a more prosperous, peaceful future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.